Open public input, and we have a handful, and you know, I think everybody knows the three minutes and the beeper and that. So call you up two at a time. Frank Urbeck and Steve Shaneweiss, please.
Chairman Smith, is this on?
Yep.
Members of the commission and Director Seth, please. I'm Frank Urbeck, speaking this morning for the sport fishing community that has been denied opportunity by the department to fish the Skokomish River for hatchery, chinook, and coho salmon since 2015 because of a land ownership dispute with the Skokomish Indian tribe. Puget Sound Anglers, Kitsap Pogie Club, Coastal Conservation Association, the Steelhead Trout Club, and I testified before you on this issue on October 27th, 2017, as well as on other occasions over the past 3 years, in an unsuccessful attempt to secure restoration of a very popular and economically important recreational fishery. Later this morning, you will decide on the North of Falcon policy for 2019. Respectfully ask that you encourage the director to do all that is possible to restore the Skokomish River recreational salmon fisheries in 2019. We will assist him and his staff in any way we can. I and other sports group representatives reached out to the Skokomish tribe a number of times in unsuccessful attempts to address tribal concerns. Clearly, the sport fishing community is disappointed over the department's failure to restore the Sport River fisheries prior to the director Kelly's Susswins taking the helm. Many of us are very upset because the department denied river access to surplus salmon produced at the George Adams hatchery while promising that a fishery would be restored. Nearly 90,000 Chinook over the last 3 years returned to the hatchery in excess of broodstock needs. At least a third of the surplus hatchery Chinook likely would have been harvested had sport anglers been allowed to fish the river. The recreational Chinook fishery alone is estimated to be worth more than $5 million annually. Media has covered this issue. You have copies, I think, were sent to you by email and also today on a couple of the articles. Public confidence in the department to secure meaningful sport fishing opportunities in 2019, including the Skokomish River, could have a bearing on whether or not badly needed increased funding is provided by the legislature for the fiscal years 20 and 21, department operating and capital budgets. Certainly acceptance of license fee increases will be problematic without meaningful opportunity. I think you all know that. Thank you.
Mr. Urbeck, I want to make sure I understand. The source of these fish that you're discussing, a lack of opportunity for, are what percentage of those are hatchery-raised fish?
Well, sports fishing people, we can only retain the hatchery fish, and I don't know the exact number, but I would say we're probably better than 90% of the fish that are returning are hatchery fish.
And the statement you made, I don't know that I'd heard this before, but the statement you made about the economics,
right?
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
We looked at the... again, this is speculation, and I developed those numbers, but I've got a master's in economics, and I used to do this kind of stuff years ago. But I did check with department staff to make sure I was in the ballpark. But we were looking at the number of fish that could possibly have been reasonably expected to be harvested in the 3 years that we couldn't. We looked at the value, the angler day value, and applied that just for the Chinook. And the $5 million is just for the Chinook. It doesn't include the benefits, economic benefits of the follow-up coho fishery, which is still also very popular.
One other follow-up. When you did that, how many angler trips did that represent, or do you know?
Yeah, we're looking at about 20,000.
All right, thank you.
Yes, Commissioner McCarthy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your testimony. We have in front of us, I think, some handouts that are perhaps part of your testimony, but I wondered if you would be able to make available your written testimony that you seem to be reading from so that we could have a look at that.
I will leave that with Tammy.
North Falcon agenda.
Thank you.
Sydney Hanson, please. And Steve.
Mr.
Chair, Director, Commissioners. My name is Steve Shanewise. I live in Olympia, Washington, and I'm here to once again discuss corn pond hunting. I submitted a third document on this issue to you that you've hopefully had time to review and would like to respond to any questions or comments you may have. But first, I'd like to relay a quick story that I think highlights the corn pond issue. In December, while hunting ducks in eastern Washington, a person who works for WDFW and knows my corn pond stance told me a story his supervisor had told him. The supervisor had been talking with some federal wardens who were thinking about doing a sting operation on a commercial hunting outfit because the wardens thought the outfit had people go out at night and physically knock down feed on the corn ponds into the water. They were apparently doing this for some reason. They were apparently doing this for the reason the outfit could not raise the water deep enough in the ponds so the waterfowl could reach the standing feed. After listening to their story, the supervisor asked the feds what the functional difference was between raising the water to the feed or knocking the feed down to the water. Either action would create the same overly attractive condition for hunting waterfowl. And the feds replied that, yes, this was true, but one action was legal and the other was not. You can raise the water to the feed, they said, but you can't lower the feed to the water because that would be illegal baiting. Commissioners, I'm here today to ask you to have the wisdom and the strength to someday declare that corn pond hunting of waterfowl is also illegal baiting. Thank you.
That was my question for Mr. Shanewise. I believe when you were here, first off, I want to appreciate the fact that you are dogging this thing. You keep our feet to the fire. When you were here last time, we talked to our staff and decided to take this to the waterfowl advisory groups, as I remember.
Yes.
And we were going to do that. And then the other thing that we were looking at is the legalities. We can't do anything here that is in violation of state law. And so the question is whether this is illegal baiting or not. And there was going to be some follow-up on that. So I'd like to ask you if you've followed through with the advisory group point. And then I also want to say that I think this one's really hard. And what I hope we keep in mind is that sometimes we have to deal with hard things one way or the other. And so we don't want to push it into the future forever. That's not what we're doing. But we really do need to be very careful as we go through to be sure that we are not acting in a way that we shouldn't. And so thank you for coming. And how's it going with the Waterfowl Advisory Group?
I have not spoken with them. I have tried to have a meeting with Kyle, but he's been busy. I was out of town hunting. I'm getting ready to send him another email this month to see if we can meet and talk about it. But I did meet with the Waterfowl Advisory Group, I think it was 2 years ago in the spring, and basically got nowhere. There was only one member who was interested in the subject and had the same feeling I did, that this is just simply baiting. But I think that there are a fair number of people on the WAG committee who hunt corn ponds, and they weren't even interested in bringing it up on an agenda. They just wouldn't discuss it. So.
Yeah, Commissioner, I made a note.
Thank you for your testimony and for coming again today. Your account of these different conversations is interesting. I think what's most interesting to me, though, is would be actually to see this federal law that folks are referring to, if it's a regulation or what. So maybe wildlife staff could help. But if you could, you know, bring that to our attention or to the wildlife folks, that would be helpful.
Yes, they actually did a review of baiting laws a few years ago, and they now have the new listing of what's baiting and what's not. And in this review, there was significant change. Like, and I think that what happened is that there were people on the committee that made up the rules for federal baiting rules that probably use corn ponds. And allowing people to flood grain to hunt completely avoids all of the prior things that dealt with baiting, which were basically the physical manipulation of the grain. You can't lay your hands on the grain. But the new laws, they specifically say it's not illegal to flood unharvested fields to hunt. And that's the thing that I want to have changed in the state of Washington. And as I've said before, Washington State can make laws that are more restrictive than the federal laws. You just can't make ones that are less restrictive.
Depends.
Well, okay. It depends. But you can say that flooding unharvested fields is considered baiting. And the reason I think that you should do that is it's absolutely no different than knocking the grain down to the water or knocking the grain down to the land. You're bringing the water up to the grain, and it makes it overly attractive for purposes of hunting.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the observation that Mr. Shane Wise pointed out. As we do our game rules on an annual basis, Kyle always reminds us that ceiling is set by the feds. It's a little different than other kinds of game because the federal government has a lot of authority on waterfowl rules because of the International Migratory Bird Act. So they give us the ceiling, but we can be more restrictive. We're always reminded of that when we're making the rules, when Kyle says, okay, this is what the feds are telling us, but we do have the opportunity to be more restrictive. And this is the baiting question that comes up with all of our species.
Any other? Yes.
And there again, I hear him, I hear you guys, but we got to be pretty careful when we're going down this road that if we're going to start making some rules that we need to make certain that we're getting it out that we're considering doing this so that we truly can get both sides of this issue. Did book the hunt.
I was wondering about that, Commissioner.
Yeah.
How'd that go? Did you get a limited greenhead?
It wasn't nearly as good as you maintain it is.
It wasn't worth your $350?
It was. Oh, we had a great time. Had a great time. But
did you hunt a corn pond or just
yes.
fields?
Yeah. Yeah. And we scored on every opportunity we had, and we ended up with two ducks and one teal. It was a crappy day. It was fogged over, cold. It just, there wasn't.
The birds weren't moving to the fields because of the fog.
Yeah.
Oh. Did they give you your money back?
Yeah, right.
No, I'm serious. They don't have a guarantee?
And no, there's no guarantee. It's hunting. It's what it is. But there again, I do guided hunts all over the country, and there's no guaranteed hunts. So, I mean, that's part of when you book these.
That begs the question, how many shells were expended?
I shot three shots.
Well, they only take cash, too, don't they?
Yeah, under the table. But really, truly, in the serious side of the deal, I did talk to the outfitter quite a bit about this issue, and I've talked to some other people about it. And it isn't just, it's no different than when we went back to debating with deer. That there's two sides to the story, and that's all I want to make certain that we get when we truly, if you're going to go ahead with this, we need to make certain that we hear both sides of the story.
I completely agree with that, and so what I'd like to do is let my colleagues know that at least I will be submitting a blue sheet at the end of the meeting tomorrow to ask for this to be on our agenda. At a future meeting and have public input in it. And it might be best if we do it at one of our future meetings on the east side. So if anybody wants to join me on that blue sheet or do it instead of me, I'm happy for that.
See, we're listening.
I just would like to share that in speaking with Kyle, I understand that another version of WAG, the Waterfowl Advisory Group, you know, doesn't meet regularly. They have a meeting in April, and Kyle is communicating with the chair of that group, and this is planned to be an agenda item at the April Waterfowl Advisory Group. If that's where it is in the process based on the previous dialogue, there is no rulemaking in front of the commission presently that's driving it in its master plan.
Thanks.
David Lynn and Cindy.
Good morning. My name is Cindy Hansen, and I'm here representing Orca Network. I spoke at the commission meeting in December and requested a fishing allocation for the endangered southern resident orcas. As I was traveling to this meeting yesterday from my home on San Juan Island, J-Pod was in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, while K and L pods were traveling in Puget Sound. Video of them was shown on Como 4 and King 5 News last night, and they were heard on a hydrophone off Whidbey Island early this morning. While not yet confirmed, there is talk of a possible newborn calf in this group. We're excited about the potential of this new birth, as there has not been a surviving calf in this population for over 3 years. But at the same time, we are apprehensive because we're unsure if there will be adequate salmon to sustain this new little one and his or her mother. We know from photogrammetry studies that there are more pregnant females in the southern resident community, and they are going to need an abundance of food in order to carry their babies to term and raise healthy infants. Therefore, I am asking you once again, as you adopt your North of Falcon policy modifications, to include a conversation about an allocation of 400,000 salmon to the southern residents in your fishing quotas for 2019, while respecting tribal fishing rights. This is the fastest way to ensure a source of food this year for these whales. I realize the difficult task you have before you, and I appreciate you taking the time to consider this request on behalf of the whales. We are still learning about how harvest allocations are determined, and we look to you for guidance on how to best achieve this, so would be open to setting up a meeting for further dialogue. Now more than ever, we must make sure that there is abundant food to sustain this possible new little L-pod whale, his or her mother, and the rest of the pregnant females, as well as the entire southern resident community of orcas. Thank you for your time.
Time to do such extensive traveling to come to our meeting here today and offer some public testimony. Thanks to you and your colleagues for doing so at the last meeting when the North of Falcon matter was open to public comment. My question is, do you have the impression that closing fisheries would provide a substantial increase in the prey availability to the orca? And I ask this in this context, the 400,000 quota for killer whale prey is larger than the return to Puget Sound, and the 400,000 20-pound category fish would amount to, you know, probably well over a million Chinook salmon, considering the spread of age classes it takes to get 400,000 20-pound category Chinook salmon. So my question is, do you have the impression that curtailment of fisheries would provide a significant increase in the amount of prey to killer whales?
I do. I do believe that not necessarily closing fisheries, even if we can't reach that 400,000 fish, setting aside some kind of a quota for them. We don't want to take away fishing, especially not from native populations, but we do want them to have their share, basically, because if they don't have that immediately, all of these other long-term restoration efforts that are taking place are going to have an impact, but not immediately, and they need that food right now, or they're not going to make it until those other recovery actions are paying off.
Thank you. Karen Romers, Clevin, please, and David.
Good morning, commissioners. My name's David. David Lynn from Ocean Shores. Probably getting tired of seeing me here, but I always have a few things to talk about. So today I want to talk about the public trust doctrine and how I think that it applies to the department. But first, I feel the need to correct the record about some comments that were made at the last meeting here in December. At that meeting, I stated that I reviewed an incident report dated September 6th, which records the injury of one calf in the old Profanity Peak territory in Ferry County. In addition to describing the injuries sustained by the calf, the report noted the cattle were located within the rendezvous site of the wolves occupying the old Profanity Peak territory. I was later followed by a speaker who claimed that my statement was an example of, quote, misinformation, which was, quote, processed and, quote, regurgitated in Olympia and then misinterpreted by the public. That is inaccurate. I reported on the unprocessed report developed at the incident site by the department staff, and I hope each of you got a copy of the report that I sent in that documents that. Okay, enough said there. The public trust doctrine holds that state controls its natural resource assets in trust for all of its citizens. While most case law to date has focused on water and shoreline issues, there is a natural extension of the doctrine to include wildlife. As such, the state has a fiduciary responsibility and a trustee-beneficiary relationship to its citizens, both current and future generations, to protect and preserve these assets. In the past, that fiduciary role has not been well executed, so today we find ourselves with so many endangered and threatened species. The extension of the public trust doctrine includes wolves, orcas, salmon, and other endangered animals. It also includes species which are not currently threatened, such as pinnipeds, cormorants, and others. The state role becomes even more important when federal protections are fully or partially removed. At the last meeting, I was moved by testimony of many of the people who spoke about the pinnipeds and what the effects of removing them would be. After that meeting, I researched the issue to more fully understand the risks of such actions. And the web of life that includes humans, orcas, sea lions, cormorants, salmon, hake, and every other animal in our environment is far too complex for humans to try to engineer. We devise simplistic solutions to complicated problems without ever understanding all of the long-term implications of our actions. So we end up in a never-ending cycle of trying to fix the very problems that we create by our solutions. Do you remember the assault on the cormorant population? It was claimed that they, too, were eating our salmon and must be killed. Now, years later, it turns out that all of that killing was in vain. We still have a salmon problem. An article in the Seattle Times dated September 18, 2015, notes that, quote, federal agents have stalked out this tiny uninhabited island with night vision goggles and silencers, blasting birds on the nest. They have oiled more than 5,000 eggs to suffocate the embryos within, and now they have taken to the water, firing at double-breasted cormorants with shotguns under a federal program intended to boost juvenile salmon and steelhead survival. That didn't work, and when the removal of pinnipeds proves futile, what will we kill next? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. And Dr. Deborah Giles, please, and
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Karen Rumors-Kleffen. I'm from Friday Harbor, San Juan Island, and I came to speak to you in December. And I'm here as a concerned citizen to give citizen input on the Norfolk Falcon policy that you're deciding on today. When I came to speak to you in December, we all experienced the demise of the southern resident killer whales over the summer, and it was very dramatic. It was in the media constantly, so everybody got to experience that. What you may not know, depending as to how much you watch the whales, since then, two other adult whales have seriously declined, are currently documented to have peanut head, which means that they are starving. And they're starving because they're still not finding enough fish. Their decline is going much, much faster than what we had expected. Nowadays, when we see a skinny whale, very shortly after becoming skinny, the peanut head occurs and then the whale disappears or we see it die. So we're really concerned that that decline is faster than what had been predicted. They're not just an iconic animal that everybody loves. They are an apex predator. They were here before us, and they had plenty of food until we developed industries around fishing, and particularly around the abundance of king chum and coho, as we're feeding the whole nation Northwest salmon and supply a lot of people in the region as well. So nature is telling us in many ways that it's no longer sustainable, and therefore we really have to look at the current methods and the strategies that we're using to make sure that things stay balanced. As these apex predators die one by one, we cannot turn a blind eye to the fact that we're impacting the entire ecosystem. You know, we see a decline in scentlands, we see a decline in herring, we see a decline in all the forage fish that the salmon eat. Salmon cannot be healthy if we don't manage that ecosystem and keep it balanced. Now, co-managers in the Department of Fish and Wildlife have a unique opportunity to bring some of the fish back into the system, and essentially by pushing a reset button and let nature recuperate for a moment and reconsider while we are reconsidering our methods and harvest allocations. All the other interventions, as you heard from Cindy, that were discussed in the task force of the governor, they all take 5 to 10 years, and some of that is going to be too late. But on the other hand, you have an incredible opportunity. You have an opportunity to dedicate as much food supply while we are working on all the other measures. The whales eat 400,000 big fish per year, as you said. That means 1 to 4 million big fish need to be available for them to be able to get that. We at least need to give them a seat at the negotiation table. Thank you.
I'm here representing my nonprofit, Wild Orca, as well as San Juan Island-based Friends of the San Juans, but I'm really here to speak for the whales. I'm glad to be here again to be able to give public comment on behalf of the federally listed endangered southern resident killer whales. Myriad threats are contributing to the decline of this population, but by far the most significant factor limiting their population growth is the lack of salmon throughout their entire range. From Southeast Alaska to Monterey, California. While volatile factors such as climate change and ocean acidification are certainly making forecasting more challenging and may be significantly contributing to the increasingly common mismatch between forecasted returns and actual salmon returns, perhaps more concerning than the unpredictability of salmon abundance is the fact that the southern residents are currently not factored into the allocations. Simply put, as the original harvesters of salmon, the whales deserve their share of the fish. As mentioned previously, there is likely a new calf, and there should be at least two more on the way. And actually, possibly more than that, but three in September were known to be pregnant. Unfortunately, the birth of these of these babies do not necessarily mean they will survive. Looking back at the so-called baby boom between December 2014 and January 2016, when 11 babies were born to this population of whales, sadly, only five remain. Moreover, photographs from last month confirm that the emaciated state of two important members of this community, K25, a breeding age male, and J17, a breeding age female, who also has a number of young that she's caring for, including her grand calf, because that her daughter died, J28 died. In order to ensure that we don't lose more members of this community, including new calves, it's our responsibility to ensure they have sufficient food, and the fastest way to do that is to set aside a portion of the fish returning, however many that may be. Acknowledging that the majority of salmon headed for rivers in the southern residents' range are harvested in Alaska, the fish that do make it back to Washington waters are absolutely critical to these whales, so having an allocation for these fish is paramount. In addition, we know that Fraser River Chinook salmon are a vitally important summer food source for the whales, but a lot of adult salmon bound for this river system are being harvested in the San Juan Islands. As I mentioned at the last meeting, I recognize that fisheries allocation is a complex process with a lot of interested parties. But as the first harvesters of these fish, these whales absolutely have to be factored in as a major stakeholder when fisheries management decisions are being made. Thank you again for the opportunity to talk and submit comments for the whales. I do very much look forward to more dialogue and would very much welcome an opportunity to sit in a quieter place and be able to speak with you more.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today. So you mentioned an allocation for, and some of the other speakers as well. And Commissioner McIsaac brought up the point that 400,000 would be, you know, more than they're actually returning to the Puget Sound area. So, and then there's been more discussion is that there should be some allocation, maybe not 400,000, but so I guess my question to you would be, how would we come up with an allocation? I mean, what's the basis upon which would we even undertake such an exercise? And what maybe, well, that's the question, I guess.
I don't know what basis you allocate the fish that you already allocate. I don't know how it is that you weigh different stakeholders already. And what I'm saying is that I think that the southern residents need to be considered a stakeholder and factored in the same way that you already allocate the fish that is available for harvest. So as I understand it, there's these predictions that are made that are constantly being updated based on the models and based on test fisheries of fish that are actually coming back. And given those numbers, the pie shrinks or enlarges and gets bigger. As I understand it, there are portions of that pie, so we get the allocation for the escapement, so those fish that escape getting killed in any other way, that's a given. We know that number of fish needs to be allowed to make it back to their natal river. The rest of the pie, so that slice has been taken out. The rest of the pie is then divvied up in a way that is quite honestly a complete mystery to me. But what I'm saying is that right now there are people at that table, stakeholders at that table, or users, harvesters as they're called. I think in your dialogue is harvesters. Those harvesters get a portion of that pie. And so I'm asking that the whales be brought to the table and be factored in to whatever is available. The whales need to be factored in at that point. Or we will simply not recover them. All these other measures of habitat restoration, those are incredibly important. But as mentioned, and as you know, that takes time.
So just to follow up, maybe I didn't ask my question clearly enough. I guess, you know, assuming that we were to set aside an allocation, as you suggest, how would we know, though, whether that allocation would actually provide any benefit to the whales? That's kind of what I'm kind of trying to understand.
Well, as Karen mentioned, the whales are incredibly tightly tied to the amount of Chinook that are available to them at any given time. We've got a lot of different research projects that are studying these animals. We have photogrammetry. We have fecal collection that occurs when weather permits year-round now. We know, we can tell you what their nutritional status is. And from the photogrammetry work, we can tell you if they're getting heavier or losing weight. So it's very, very closely tied. And then quite honestly, the birds, northern resident killer whales who are fish eaters as well, they had something like 10 births this year, and they've all lived. So I think a really obvious way of knowing that it's working is that we get females that are pregnant. We can tell you that they're pregnant from their fecal hormones. Those females are able to bring the calves to full term, and the calf lives. That's how we know. So it's pretty quick.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you all. And well-presented testimony this morning.